Hi, it's Vic. Just to let you know that there is a mention of suicidal ideation in this episode. Coming up on Bookshelfie.
I read to live. Like, I really feel that, you know, if I stop reading, I will die. Like, that is the time to worry.
I like that. Let's be dramatic about the importance of it.
It really
I get that.
Just disclaimer, I love Instagram and I have quite a healthy relationship with it, but it's because I have a deep mistrust of it.
Okay.
And, you know.
Isn't it funny that a healthy relationship has to be built on a deep mistrust?
Exactly.
That's the only way to do
where
it.
Where tech bros are involved, I absolutely stand by that statement. This is something I say constantly to children. If you're writing, you're a writer.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only qualification. There are plenty of adults who are published authors who aren't, I would consider, writers because they're not, you know, they're not investing. They like the accoutrements of it. But the real work, that's where it is. You know, there's stories that are waiting to be told that I've thought about for, you know, 8-10 years. One story that I long to tell that I'll probably be waiting another 40 years to tell just because it's not the right time for me to write it. But I know that they'll still be there waiting for me. And that's what I love about writing as well as reading.
Hello, I'm Vic Hope, and this is Bookshelfie, the podcast from the Women's Prize that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the 5 books by women that have shaped them. Now, before we begin, remember to subscribe or follow so you never miss an episode, with thanks to our sponsor, Baileys. Today, I'm joined by Kieran Millward Hargrave. Kieran is an award-winning poet, playwright and novelist. The Mercies was her first novel for adults and became an instant Sunday Times bestseller. It won a Betty Trask Award, was longlisted for the Jalak Prize, and was named among the New York Times 100 most notable books of 2020. Her best-selling works for children include The Girl of Ink and Stars, and her new book, Almost Life, a queer love story that spans decades, is out now. Welcome. You know what? It turns out that we were at uni at the same time together.
I know, and we've never met.
And we've not
but
met.
Here we are.
Well, it's lovely to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
I would love to know where your reading takes you, because as someone who writes for both children and adults, do you feel like your reading is shaped by your writing, like who you're writing for and when you're writing?
That's such an interesting question. So I read to live. Like, I really feel that, you know, if I stop reading, I will die. Like, that is the time to worry.
I like that. Let's be dramatic about the importance
about,
of it.
It's so central to my mental health, my identity, everything, that I have always read incredibly widely. And I used to think that was a bit of a, not a downfall, but a bit of a weakness, that I didn't have one thing that I really connected with and really cared about, that I read so diversely. But now I think it's such a blessing, because yeah. I think I wouldn't be writing in all these different genres if I hadn't always been reading very widely as well.
All the worlds that you have been able to escape to find yourself in.
Exactly.
Oh, it's, of course it's a blessing. And do you read children's books as much as writing?
I absolutely do. I've become one of those very evangelical children's authors. Don't get children's authors started on how everyone should be reading children's books. We're very committed to the idea. And I think it should work a bit more like film ratings. You know how a U is just suitable for everyone.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of how I approach children's books. If something's really good, it's just appropriate for everyone. There's just no lower limit, and there's certainly no upper limit. And I think it's a real shame. I think we do miss a lot of the really bold storytelling that's happening by dismissing and diminishing children's books, and certainly having a toddler now appreciating the genius of picture books. If you can read a book 50 times, sometimes in one night, and not want to throw it across the room, it's a great book. And that is certainly the case with some of her picture books.
I feel you now. I do. Those owl babies. I don't know if you read owl babies.
I love owl babies. We're on to the owl who is afraid of the dark now.
We'll get there.
You will.
But currently we're reading owl babies for the 1,000th time. But we still love it.
Of course. Of course.
I love that idea of not just paying heed, which we do in films, to the lower limit, but also the upper limit, and the fact that there probably shouldn't be either.
Yeah.
With so much of this important culture. Now, your new book, Almost Life, it's a queer romance. It begins as a summer love in the late 1970s in Paris. What drew you to this story? Why did you need to write it?
So I was writing something totally different this time 2 years ago. In fact, I think it was the 8th of May that I started writing Almost Life. And I was writing a horror story set in the dying days of the British Raj, because I have mixed heritage, Indian and British, and I wanted to kind of explore that push and pull identity. But then three things happened. I listened endlessly to Good Luck Babe by Chapel Roan. I watched Past Lives, the Celine song film, and I watched the One Day TV adaptation. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I didn't want to be writing a horror novel anymore. I wanted to write a love story. And I literally... you've already noticed I'm dramatic. I cast aside my work in progress, you know,
physically threw it out the window.
I cannot do this anymore. 50,000 words just was like, this is not what my soul needs right now. And I started writing Almost Life, and all my books begin with an image. And the image in this book was a girl walking towards another girl on the steps of the Sacré-Cœur in Paris. And yeah, it's always an image and a question, and I just wanted to know who they were and what they were going to come to mean to each other.
That's beautiful. And this idea that you follow your soul with your writing, do you do the same with your reading? Would you cast a book aside if you're reading it and thinking, this is not what my soul needs right now?
So I was raised to be diligent, you know, give the book the respect, finish it, and now I'm like completely disrespectful. I'm incredibly monogamous, apart from when it comes to reading. I will just cast one aside. I will read two at the same time. Sometimes in one night I'm like, okay, I've had enough of that one now,
really?
Put it down.
Okay.
I'm really, it's what my brain needs now, and I don't know whether that says something about attention span, but I think it's more just life is so short.
Yeah.
And if I'm not feeling something, I'll never blame the book. I will never blame the book. I think it's all about mood and sort of just where you are in that moment. But yeah, I absolutely will just give myself permission to follow what I want and need in that moment.
You can come back to it,
yeah,
another time when it's right. And I don't think it's disrespectful. I think it's respectful to yourself and your needs.
And to the writer. They don't want you to be hate reading their
book. You're resenting it.
Leave it. It's not their fault.
Well, let's follow your soul right now and the books that you have loved, that you have needed at times in your life. And the first is Jimala Gavin's Corran Boy. Corran Boy is a haunting and captivating work of historical fiction for children. The Corran Man takes babies and money from desperate mothers, promising to deliver them safely to a foundling hospital in London. Instead, he murders them and buries them by the roadside, to the helpless horror of his mentally ill son, Mish. Mish saves one, Aaron, who grows up happily unaware of his history, proving himself a promising musician. As Aaron's new life takes him closer to his real family, the watchful Mish makes a terrible mistake, delivering Aaron and his best friend Toby back into the hands of the Corran Man. I got such a pang of nostalgia seeing this on your notes. I'd forgotten about reading it and being immersed in it. What do you remember about reading this for the first time?
Horror. Terror, but also a genuine physical, like I was being pushed down in my seat and being made to pay attention to something that I never knew existed. And I think children love to be afraid. Like, I still quite like horror films and things, but I used to love anything that made my heart beat fast, my palms sweat. And this book, it is horrifying. You can hear in the concept, yeah, it's horrifying, but it's also incredibly humane. It's incredibly vividly and beautifully written. And Jimala Gavin, in all her stories, has such a skill for telling you straight, but always being aware that you might be encountering something for the first time. So she holds your hand, and I think you feel safe with her. She's not going to pull the rug out. So I remember, feeling like I was being held down in my chair and being not forced, but being made to hear something I needed to hear. And I did, you know, as viscerally as with Noughts and Crosses, I felt changed after reading it.
Yeah, you mentioned Noughts and Crosses, Mallory Blackman. I think that would probably be on my list as a formative book, or a book that made me see the world in a way that has shaped my entire moral compass. Why do you mention them in the same breath?
I think there are moments in both the books, and I think the moment for me with with noughts and crosses is the moment where they get a skin coloured plaster, and you know it doesn't match Malcolm's skin, and he sort of, it's too dark on his skin. And then I realised, yeah, obviously flesh coloured is white, and it just had never been so clear to me. And then in Corum Boy, it's when Aaron sings, and it's sort of in the juxtaposition of, it's a really bracing, and I apologise to listeners because it's really upsetting, where the children are being buried, the babies are being buried, and the filling of the mouth, and then what his beautiful voice could do, and the fact that all those voices were taken. And I was like, oh God, it really is just birth, an accident of birth. Mm-hmm. You know, fate is so fickle and decides so much. And I think, yeah, I felt like I'd grown up a bit through reading it.
Did you feel at all triggered, or something had been sparked or awakened in you? How was it formative?
Yeah, I think triggered in the sense of the word as I would have understood it then, as in activated. I think, I mean, now I find it triggering in different ways. Mm. But definitely it activated a sense of injustice. It made me understand that whoever has control of the narrative has the power. And it's important that good people control the narrative, because, you know, who gets to tell what story can completely form who gets our empathy, what we value in people, or if we even value people. So I think it really, I found it very confronting in just that there was, the world was so full of a cruelty that I had never had to think about. And obviously this is something that happened in Victorian Britain, but I think it just made me aware that the world was so much more full of darkness, but that there's always light as well. So I think it also just sparked a love of darkness in books, I think, for me. I've always enjoyed going there, but there always has to be leavened a bit with hope for me.
There's something about that darkness being expressed and your hand being held through it, like you said, for children, when your moral compass is so clear. And I remember reading Noughts and Crosses, also To Kill a Mockingbird, and nothing had been compromised yet for me. I hadn't had to compromise what I thought was right and just to get by. And so it was so clear that it was unjust. And then we live our lives and we sort of just do what we have to do a little bit more. But can you remember young Kieran reading this book so sure of what is right and wrong? What were you like? Were you a little activist in a way after reading this?
I wouldn't go that far because I was still ultimately a bookish child, mm-hmm. and would prefer to sort of have my confrontations in my head. Okay. But I certainly started to see things in different shades a lot more. And, you know, there's always a moment where you realise the world is so much bigger than you ever imagined and could hold so much more possibility. And I think it emboldened me to sort of speak up a bit more. Yeah. And if I saw, you know, for instance, bullying or something, I felt like I could confront that situation because I saw what an escalation could be. So I wouldn't say it was like my Damascene moment, but it was a slow awakening for me, and I have become more and more radical as I've aged, and also become a lot less entrenched. I think that was, you know, another thing is, like you said, you're very sure of what's right and wrong, and I think it's really important to have those shades of grey and start to make everything more complex, because that's the world we live in. And so whilst I have become more certain of what's right and wrong, I'm also a lot more aware of the complexity.
Yeah. And you said about the importance of reading children's literature. How much has this book particularly influenced your writing?
I mean, the looking for unseen history is like my bread and butter. That's what I love to read. It's what I love to write. And I love taking that to the extreme as well, where, you know, reading books about imagined alternate realities, like in Noughts and Crosses. But every story has already been told and it's already happened. And I find that incredibly encouraging and moving. Yeah. I think the fact that human imagination can still bring stories afresh when they've already happened and existed, I find that really beautiful about people that we have this skill. And it certainly teaches me to go back into sort of go back into the past. And that's where so much of the richness of our present and our future lies. And you can learn so much from those stories.
And so many new perspectives. There are always new perspectives to uncover. Even if we feel we've heard the story told 1,000 times, think about the people whose voices perhaps weren't heard. And on the subject of new perspectives, let's talk about your second book, Shelfie Book, which is On Photography by Susan Sontag. A seminal and groundbreaking work, first published in 1977, Susan Sontag's critique of photography asks forceful questions about the moral and aesthetic issues surrounding this art form and feels more pertinent today than ever. Photographs are everywhere, and the insatiability of the photographing eye has profoundly altered our relationship with the world. In these 6 incisive essays, Sontag examines the ways in which we use these omnipresent images to manufacture a sense of reality and authority in our lives. How did you come across this book? I've got a note here that you found it on your lover's bedside table. Tell me more.
That's very, very romantic. Yeah, so I fell in love very inconveniently in my first year at university, having really looked forward to sowing some wild oats, and was like, damn it. And it ended up being the man I married as well, which is very inconvenient. But he was a painter, an artist, and he read a lot of art theory. And I have to say, I was like, yawn. And then I just liked the cover. I've always been a bit, I'm going to call it a magpie, but actually I'm just a thief. I steal books from people I know.
Oh, you're one of those.
I'm one of those, yeah.
I forgive you because, you know, we're all about sharing here.
Yeah, sure, sure. No, one of my best friends won't lend me a book because she knows this about me. But he had On Photography, you know, dog-eared, and I was like, well, he was running away from me at this point as well, so I was like, let's read this and impress him with my skills. You know, I was 18, forgive me. But I read it and I just felt my brain explode. Mm. Like, I'd never read an art theory book before, and I imagined that they were dry. And when you read Susan Sontag, there is a confrontation in the way that she writes that is, it's critical. It's like, you are implicit in this. And this is a book that's all about, as you said, how photography changes our relationship with reality, and how, especially she talks very interestingly about, for example, war photographers and how they become complicit in the crimes that they sort of are photographing, and yet the camera allows them to dodge that complicity, and so that's extra harmful. And it was just at the stage of, you know, Facebook was really taking off. We'd left MySpace behind when it was all, you know, take them up from up here. But photography was becoming a really integral part of how we connected with people, and it was starting to get easy to share images. You weren't having to pay, you know, 20p every time you sent a photograph anymore. And it just made me think, you know, about authenticity, about how people curate reality. And again, I think it links to the Quorum Boy in how we shape a narrative is really important and weighted in ways that I think a lot of people don't always realise. And I think we're now far enough into the Instagram phase that a lot of us are aware of the curated nature of image and how that can harm. But there's still just this instant access we feel we have to the truth, you know, minute by minute, when actually you're always just looking at a snapshot, a moment that can never tell a whole truth. And I think that it really relates to how we consume news nowadays. And, you know, I have turned absolutely to, since Twitter died, I've turned absolutely to Instagram for my news. But it's still only part of the story. And it can also, the access to certain images can sometimes really paralyze. You know, we're not designed to be able to consume this level of trauma. And it can really almost become unhelpful. That doesn't mean I think we should look away, but also I think sometimes people think it's enough to just see it.
Yeah.
And that's not action. That's just consumption.
The way we engage has completely changed, and it's not even necessarily real. That's the other thing. I heard, and I don't know if this is true or if this was a few years ago, but it was something like in the last year, there have been more selfies taken than there are all photographs put together in the rest of history.
That makes me feel depressed, and I don't know what. I think where my brain goes when I hear that is not necessarily that we're becoming so obsessed with our own image. It's more like the data that that's eating and the environmental impact of storing all those selfies that makes me sad.
And flipping the camera around as well, that's a very interesting phenomenon in itself. I heard Rosalia, who I'm obsessed with, say that her take on life is that there are no perfect mirrors in nature. We are not supposed to look at ourselves more than we look at others. And yet here we are. And so when you talk about, are we really getting the truth in a snapshot? Imagine when we flip that on ourselves and we're still not quite getting the truth about the person that we actually are.
I mean, we're all being given dysmorphia by our cameras. Like, because they're not even cameras. They're computers that interpret an image. You know, a phone camera is not, it's a computer. It's not a camera. It doesn't even fully reflect what the truth
is. It's flipped. It's weird.
It's weird.
with all this in mind, do Susan Sontag's observations still feel as relevant as ever?
They feel more relevant. They feel almost essential reading. And I think along with the Society of the Spectacle, she really gets to the nub of something where in a world where we are told that we are more connected than ever, it's so easy to feel alone and disconnected. And actually a lot of the tools we were given, being told this is how you build a community. I think with Twitter, we saw the warning shots. We were like, this can be taken away from you. I had real friends on Twitter, I felt. But as soon as Twitter went, it was gone. That community had gone. And, you know, social media, I think we're all sort of wising up to the fact that I love Instagram. I have quite a healthy relationship with it, but it's because I have a deep mistrust of it.
Okay.
And, you know.
Isn't it funny that a healthy relationship has to be built on a deep mistrust?
Exactly.
That's the only way to do it.
Where tech bros are involved, I absolutely stand by that statement. I think that I reread it in sort of preparing for this, and I was just sort of jaw on the floor, like reading bits out to my partner, like husband. I was just like, this should be required reading before, you know, we let a teenager sign up to an account. It's like my mum let me know about subliminal messaging and advertising before she started letting me watch TV unsupervised. It's like, you know, you don't want to sound like a nut, but like there is a lot of manipulation happening, and it's all driven towards consumption and making money for a select few, and you are the product with Instagram.
When you said that this book gave you a little explosion in your brain, that intellectual stimulation, did it prompt you to read more art theory? What part does art play in your creative life?
It's now it's so unchic to admit that a man has, you know, given you such an essential part of yourself.
He didn't get it, he just left it lying around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You found it.
But he really helped me slow down and learn to look. I think that the greatest gift he will always have given me is learning to give something my full attention. The first time I spent time in front of a painting for more than sort of long enough to sort of, okay, what's going on? Okay, move on. I cried.
What a feeling.
And it really, I was like, God, you can really access this just by looking at something and actually really seeing something. And I think that is now something that I very much bring to my books, and it in a very explicit way, in almost life, a character teaches another character to look at a painting. And it feels like a superpower. It's like an instant cheat. It must be what it feels like to be able to meditate, which I can't do. But, you know, that stillness and finding that connection with something and giving it your full attention, and that translates so intimately into love. And I think that's why that book, reading that book, not only exploded my brain, but also made me fall completely and hopelessly in love with this person. Because they were just reading this stuff and their brain was full of it, and I was greedy for it. I wanted to learn more.
Well, a painting can be a meditation on any given subject, as can poetry, which brings us onto our third bookshelfy book today, which is The Wild Iris by Louise Gluck. Published in 1992, this Pulitzer Prize-winning poetry collection is written in the language of flowers. It describes a year in and around a garden, written in three voices: the gardener, an omniscient godlike figure, and the plants themselves, covering the seasons, death, and the cycle of life. Now, this book was a source of solace and nourishment for you at a time that was quite traumatic in your life. Can you talk about your relationship with this collection?
Of course. So poetry has always been part of the fabric of my reading life, because my father, first of all, wanted to be a poet, but he was the son of a factory worker in Yorkshire, and that just wasn't going to happen for his son. So, but he grew up, reading us Auden and Eliot, and I grew up understanding poetry that's something that came alive out loud. Mm. And so I read The Wild Iris when I was at university, and I was very depressed. A traumatic incident had happened to me, and I was stuck in the moment of trauma. And my partner bought me a stack of poetry books because my brain couldn't settle. I said earlier that reading is life to me, and when I stop reading, something bad's going on, and I couldn't read. But poetry, I could sit with a page, yeah. I could sit with a moment. And that's what poetry does, is it takes you into a moment. And there's the form of it that's short, but there's such richness in that. And so I still felt like I was being fed, like I was being nourished, even when huge parts of my brain were numb. And The Wild Iris speaks so beautifully about death at a time when suicide ideation was part of my daily life. And instead of feeling afraid of that, it almost became a comfort. It became like, you can do this because it's always there. Like, death is a constant companion. And I don't know if you've read Duck the Death and the Tulip, but it's a similar, it's like that in a poetry collection, in that it takes you by the hand and it walks with you through the dying of a garden, through the beautiful blooming and then the quiet stillness, and then the cycle starts again. And the title poem is really about that. It's about what comes after. And yes, there's a metaphysical, spiritual aspect to it, but there's also just a concrete biological aspect to it, that we are all living things, and we all are earth and stars. And I just found the grounding of that incredibly comforting, even though I think I read them as quite bleak. And again, I reread the title poem in preparation for this, and actually now it's all about life to me. It's all about, it's all about the moments that matter. And so I love that about poetry as well. They are so ambiguous, and they can change depending on what you're bringing to them so much.
Well, charting that life cycle of that garden means that you are going to run through those seasons cyclically, and whenever you come to it, it could be a different part, but it will rise again.
Exactly.
That titular poem is it's about survival and healing and life force. Does it still resonate with you now, but in different ways? You return to the collection?
Completely different. And it makes me think of my daughter. It makes me think of my daughter in our garden. It makes me think of her smelling flowers and going, just because we've taught her that's what you do with a flower.
Yeah, that's what you do. And my son's definitely going to say, oh, that's a beautiful flower every time, just because that's what I do. Isn't it a beautiful flower?
It's the things we pass on.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited that will be, and I hope it doesn't mean to her what it meant to me, but I hope it means something to her. And I hope that, like my father passed poetry to me, I hope that that's something I can pass to her.
Are there any poems that you particularly associate with your father?
I mean, the four quartets. He recites those often, which I love. And also Beowulf, the Seamus Heaney translation. Mm-hmm. He read that aloud to me and my brother on holiday. We're a cool family. And me and my brother were crying, like, when Grendel's mother came out, because it was so scary. I was 10.
Okay,
I was
too young. That was actually, you were young. You felt
like,
it.
I felt it. It was like, it was really, he's very into like Norse sagas and stuff. He's convinced he's a Viking, even though we did his family tree. It's just Yorkshire all the way back.
So even though he wasn't able to fulfill his dreams of becoming a poet, does he still get to be a poet?
Well, I think he's a poet. I've read some of his work, and I think he's a poet. And I think what's so beautiful about my dad is he has always been so pro me writing. You know, my mum had the whole, sure, you don't want to be a lawyer.
Okay, you know, but it was your dad who...
My dad was like, you need to do this. Wow. Like, and he said to me last night, actually, he said, I'm so proud that we have a poet in the family.
Gosh.
Had a moment. He is too sweet for this world, my dad.
And you're right, just because he's not a published poet doesn't mean he's not a poet. He's a poet.
Well, this is something I say constantly to children. If you're writing, you're a writer. Yeah. Like, that's all. That's the only qualification. There are plenty of adults who are published authors who aren't, I would consider, writers, because they're not, you know, they're not investing. They like the accoutrements of it. But the real work, that's where it is.
This episode of Bookshelfie is sponsored by Baileys. Baileys is proudly supporting the 2026 Women's Prize for Fiction, helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes. Kieran, let's talk about your fourth Bookshelfie pick, which is Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton. This is a gripping psychological thriller from the Women's Prize long-listed author of The Rehearsals and The Luminaries, which gives an unflinching examination of the human impulse to ensure our own survival. 5 years ago, Meera Bunting founded a guerrilla gardening group, Burnham Wood, planting crops wherever no one will notice, on the sides of roads, in forgotten parks and neglected backyards. For years, the group has struggled to break even until a landslide offers the opportunity of a sizable farm. But Meera is not the only one interested. An American billionaire has snatched it up to build his end times bunker, testing the ideals and ideologies of all involved. Now, you've described this book as wry, funny, devastating. What stood out to you the most about it?
I think that humour that she has. The thing I love about Catton's work is she always swings and swings big. Like, it's similar quality to Margaret Atwood in that she will always try something. And so far, I don't think that Catton's actually failed, but like, you just know you can follow her and she will always be pushing herself and you as the reader. And this made me laugh out loud from like the very first page. I read it on our baby moon and I was just the whole day just like cackling. And it's pretty dark at points as well. There's a lot of a stickiness and a lot of uncomfortable reflections about millennial culture and take attitudes to life. But I think the humour is really what stays with me. And when you describe it, you know, you're like, it's the humour about, you know, our different approaches to the end of the world, I suppose, and community, and how some people go into isolationism when they're afraid and other people reach out for community. And I think that's another big thing I took for this book, is that you have to make your own village. You are part of the village. Like, you know, you have to be an active participant in community. And I think that's what this book also wrestles with, about how in a time when we're all told to be individual, it's actually more important to be in community with each other.
It really does grapple with multiple global social crises, ecological and identity crises as well. Are you drawn to fiction that quite boldly confronts the anxieties of our time?
Absolutely, because I'm so anxious. I love reading what clever people have to say, and I love it particularly in fiction because, you know, they deliver their messages so entertainingly. And I think that that's what she really succeeds in this book, is I don't think she's trying to bass you over the head with a message, but you certainly come out with a point of view. Mm. And I really admire that. And it's something I really liked about Creation Lake as well by Rachel Kushner, is that it wasn't necessarily a point of view I connected with, but I think it's so important for fiction to deliver, you know, different perspectives and make us confront our own, therefore. And I really, that book has stayed with me so solidly. When, you know, I read so much, I read constantly. And whenever someone's like, I want to read a good book, I always recommend Byrne and Wood, because I think there's just something for everyone in it.
There's also the theme of polyamory. And you have mentioned in your notes a particular...
I shouldn't have done this.
A particular passage, when you said there's something for everyone, there's a particular passage that struck a chord in there.
I shouldn't have done this. So polyamory to me has just always sounded exhausting. And it was just really refreshing, having read lots of books that made me feel like I just wasn't getting something, to read a book where it sort of describes a polyamorous relationship. And it does just sound exhausting.
Yeah.
And like the logistics, and there is still, you know, it's not this, I think utopia is always such an interesting theme in a book. And it sort of, polyamory in theory feels like utopia, where no one is property, everyone just gets to follow what makes them happy and everyone is fulfilled. But of course that's not how people work. You know, of course there are still jealousies and power imbalances. And it's only, I think it's like a 3-page basically rant about polyamory.
Just a bit.
But it's funny and I connected with it very deeply. So if anyone else is sort of looking at polyamory thinking, what am I not getting? It's okay, you don't have to get it. Read Byrne and Wood. It's not for everyone.
Contrary to its name.
Exactly.
What lessons did you put, you say she's not trying to hit us over the head with any sort of moralizing, but what lessons did you take from this book in terms of survival in precarious times? I mean, how do we make sure that the guerrilla gardeners come out on top?
Well, I think it's first of all accepting that not everyone thinks they should. And I think that that's very confronting. But for me, it's doing everything I can to make sure they do. So it's participating, it's showing up even when you don't feel like it or you don't want to, it's getting involved in local as well as global movements. And the difference that you can make to your neighbour's life, that is as valid as the difference you can make to by contributing to a charity campaign. You know, it's really seeing yourself as part of an ecosystem. And I think that seeing ourselves as part of nature is half the battle. If we can return to feeling that we are in that habitat, that we are sharing habitat rather than conquering it or having to fight it, I think. And I'm not saying the guerrilla gardeners, I'm fully on their side either, because this book goes some places and I'm like, I do not condone this. But it certainly is interesting to juxtapose those two extremes and realise that actually most people probably would want to live somewhere in the middle, but fear keeps people apart. And actually I think when we become more afraid, that's what I do when I see something upsetting on Instagram or on the news or just outside. There are kites, red kites in our garden, they're killing all the fledglings at the moment. I'm like, it's just nature.
No,
but you know, do something, you know. Donate to somewhere or call someone who you know is having a hard time, and it just helps to reconnect and be like, don't be afraid, don't withdraw, reach out.
Yeah.
Like that's what I've been trying to do more.
I always feel more inclined to do what I can in my own community because I can see how it might tangibly help. This is aside from, you know, cynicism around the overheads with big, you know, global charity work or whatever, but it gives a new meaning to grassroots, doesn't it, when we think about it in terms of gardens.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Well, when it comes to the home and our communities and what is directly around us, it feels very pertinent to talk about your fifth and final Bookshelfy book, which is The Carrier Bag of Fiction by Ursula K. Le Guin. In this influential essay, visionary science fiction author Le Guin retells the story of human origin by focusing on what heroic, quote-unquote, storytelling leaves out. Prior to the preeminence of sticks, swords and killing tools, Le Guin argues that our ancestors' greatest invention was actually the container, the basket of wild oats, the medicine bundle, the net made of your own hair, the home, the shrine, the place that contains whatever is sacred. This essay pushes back on well-known masculine hero narratives focused on power and domination and invites us instead to see the value of stories which reflect everyday life, arguing that stories can be containers of ordinary experiences like relationships, community, and daily tasks, which are just as worthy of fiction. This is an iconic piece by Ursula K. Le Guin. Why have you chosen it? When did you come across it?
I only read it about 4 years ago. I think that's correct. And it really just affirmed the philosophy that I had already been prescribing to probably since about 2016, let's say, you know, about how we have really been done dirty by the pervasive narratives, like all of us, like men and women and everyone else as well. Everyone is being harmed by the current system, and obviously I have to believe in karma because it's all that keeps me sane. So I do believe that all will be harmed at some point. But I just loved how plainly and cleanly she sets out a case for care and a case for love. And as a children's author, you're kind of contractually obliged to believe in love as a very powerful motivating force. But it really is, you know, more than fear and more than Ursula Le Guin uses an example in this essay of how they found a sort of an ancient skeleton where the shin bone had been broken and reset. And, you know, this kind of goes against this idea of these nomadic peoples who were just kind of, you know, survival was moving on. This was someone who survived long enough for their bone to heal. Mm. And they could not have done that on their own. They were looked after. They were splinted. They were carried, maybe, in order to survive. And, you know, in a sort of survival of the fittest mentality where it's a race to who can have the most of everything, I think it just reminds us again of this idea of community and how resources shared mean everyone has enough. Mm-hmm. And I also, so that's one strand of it that I really connected with, about, you know, we don't always have to prescribe to this idea of sort of the phallic sort of linear structure through a story, and actually we can sit in the domestic, and that's no less powerful or important. And obviously that then brings in a very feminist or rather a woman centric strand where our stories are as important. And I think that links back to the untold histories that we were talking about, where, you know, there's always counterbalance and there's always weight in other places and there's always that other perspective. And people say that it's been overdone now, but I'm here for all the feminist retellings of every myth going.
We're getting them. We keep getting them and we keep loving them. We need them. They're important. Yeah. And let it continue.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of those do sort of bring the carrier bag theory of fiction to the fore, because they're not slotting women into the heroic role.
No.
They're recasting what heroism is and what it means. And, you know, certainly becoming a mother myself, I have a whole new like respect for anyone who mothers in any way, and the strength. And I think terms like strength and hero have been hijacked by the sort of traditionally what we would consider male sort of traits, but they are soft. It goes back again to what I was saying about love. Like, these soft things are strong and they are the building blocks of everything. And I think that this essay, the reason I chose this essay instead of like a whole book, is that I hope people will just go and find it and just read it, because you can just read it in 10 minutes and it just holds so much. And it gives you hope, I think, because it's there in our DNA, caring and carrying. It's there.
I felt this newfound respect, admiration, awe for all women, right back to the beginning of humankind.
Yes.
In no time frame, literally all of history ever, when I gave birth. But it wasn't just the giving of birth. It doesn't have to necessarily manifest in that respect. It was just womanhood in general. It took on a new meaning to me.
Absolutely.
And looking at it that way, there is no limit to the stories that could be retold. Where do you go about finding the stories that you feel are hidden that you would like to bring to the light?
I'm the least cynical person, which sounds like humble brag, but it's really not useful when your job is writing. Like, 'cause sometimes it would be good to be able to do what worked before and just do that again, and because that's what sometimes what readers want as well. But I have to, it's such an instinctive, heartfelt process for me. I have to go with the image, which is very much the work of subconscious. Like every single book has had an image. And so there's partly that, but then there's now, because I write for publication, there's always a gap of at least, apart from with Almost Life, at least sort of 6 months to a year before I can actually get to the idea. So it has to stick.
Right. You let it marinate.
I let it marinate. So everything that doesn't truly speak to my soul falls away in that time. And it's a really useful process. And I think if I'm still in love with it in 6 months, a year, I know that I will love it forever. And, you know, there's stories that are waiting to be told that I've thought about for, you know, 8-10 years. So one story that I long to tell that I'll probably be waiting another 40 years to tell, just because it's not the right time for me to write it. But I know that they'll still be there waiting for me. Yeah. And that's what I love about writing as well as reading.
Yeah, that same thing that you were saying earlier, that sometimes it's not the right moment to read a certain thing. Sometimes it's not the right moment to write a certain thing either, but it can stay with you. It still lives inside of you. This essay advances counter-arguments to prevailing ideas on human evolution, but it's also, at the same time, it's highly poetic. It's this beautiful meditation on existence. Are you drawn to the balance of those two elements, particularly when it comes to nonfiction? And then how does that influence, in turn, your storytelling?
There always has to be that balance of poetry and pace for me. I think it's because I was raised on a diet of poetry where every word is so exact. And I think that people do the term lyricism and poetry dirty. It doesn't mean like fluff. It means exactitude. Mm-hmm. It means care. It means like it hits you exactly where it needs to. And, you know, there are plenty of different ways, therefore, to be lyrical or poetic. But yeah, I really respond to Le Guin's writing in the way that it balances making a really bold and strong argument with just you wanting to like wrap yourself up in her words. And that's something that I've always sort of, I particularly love magical realism and you know, people like Allende, who just really managed to, it's like she writes thrillers.
Oh, I get so excited to get into another Allende book.
I know.
It's just, I'm just like, give me that magic, just bathe me in it.
Exactly, it is. It's like, or Rose Tremaine, like, has that quality too, where you just, yeah, it's luscious. And my publisher for adults, their slogan is, we believe the way a story is told is just as important as the story itself. Mm. And that's totally it for me. If there's not some spark or some richness, I definitely lean towards the Baroque in my taste for wanting words that surprise and sort of delight me.
And I think that's really reflected in your choices today, because I don't think we've ever had on this podcast someone who's chosen essays, poetry for the majority of their books. How interested are you in just playing with different forms of writing beyond the novel?
Yeah, it wasn't a deliberate thing. It just, this is what best reflects my taste. And as a writer as well as a reader, so I began by writing poetry and published a couple of collections before I even thought of writing fiction. And when I was writing my first book, which turned out to be a children's book, I didn't know that it was going to be a children's book.
Okay.
It was sort of, then it made sense that it was, and it became obvious that it was. But, you know, really it was just about reveling in the landscape that I was writing in, like discovering, it's about a mapmaker's daughter, and it's about discovering that landscape along with my main character. And I really think that I've carried that delight through with me. And I especially love books like, a very close contender for this list was The Blind Assassin by Margaret Atwood, because again, she plays, the intertextuality of that book is so playful. I think it's so much fun to sort of, I love it when a book has lots of different forms. You know, I'm one of those people who won't ever skim when they've got a page of like texts between characters. I'm like, yeah, give me the texts. So yeah, I think you can do anything in fiction and sometimes in nonfiction too. And I think that's just something I love, just the endless inventiveness of the human mind.
Well, from all of that endless inventiveness and your eclectic selection that you've brought today, if you had to pick one favourite, which would it be and why?
I think I would probably say The Wild Iris, because I think poetry is like origami to me. I think I can endlessly unfold it into new forms, and I would never get tired of reading those poems.
What an erudite, exquisite way of putting it. It's like origami. That's beautiful, as has been chatting to you. Thank you so much, Kieran. I've absolutely loved it.
Me too. Thank you so much.
I'm Vic Hope, and that was Bookshelfie from the Women's Prize, supported by Baileys and produced by Birdline Media. Thanks for joining me for this episode. You'll find all the books that we discussed in our show notes. There's also a link to our bookshop.org shelf, where every purchase supports independent bookshops and the work of the Women's Prize Trust, a charity helping build a better future by championing women's writing. Now remember to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. And if you liked this one, then leave us a rating or review to help other readers discover even more brilliant books by women. I'll see you next time.